This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello, I have two questions for you. Here's one. Is it fair that people paying less in rent in an apartment block than others are denied the right to walk through the same door as those people paying higher rents, forced to use what are sometimes called poor doors instead of the main entrance that others use? That's one question. Here's another. Is it fair that people paying less in rent in an apartment block get less artwork or plants in their hallways or just more frugally appointed common areas? Is that fair because, look, they don't pay the same? Now, this isn't illegal. It's very legal. It's absolutely not breaking any planning rules. But what do you think? How does it fit with, well, I guess the egalitarian values that we like to think that we have? Today, you're going to hear from a woman who is in affordable housing in the inner north. She doesn't have to walk in a different door, but she does live on a different floor from others. And so when she gets into the lift and presses the button with others, she's effectively telling them about her finances because everyone knows which floors are which. How does that make her feel? How would you feel with that? It's not illegal, as I say. So if you think it's wrong, what's the government got to do with that? Tell me what you think should happen. Is this just all a part of you get what you pay for? Where are the lines around that? Where do you think? Also today, the coffee clash continues. I will be talking about that. I was stirring the pot yesterday. Call me a has-been. That will be part of it. That's later this hour. But another question. When has a cover outshone the original? I'm asking because these spring chickens have their new workout, their 25th album, including a couple of covers, including this one. You recognise the song, it's a cover of Amy Winehouse, and you recognise the voice, that's brand new work from The Stones. The album is called Foreign Tongues, it's just new out. Tell me if you've heard it, have The Stones still got it in their 80s? But also, when has the cover been better than the original? I know that you're thinking of it right now. You tell me about it. This is my vote for it. The Bangles smashing out a version of Simon and Garfunkel's Hazy Shade of Winter. I think it's the definitive version. When has the cover outshone the original for you? Tell me the best covers. Tell me what you think of me after yesterday attacking Melbourne Coffee. But next, what is it like living in an apartment block that separates the haves and have-nots?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So what is the tipping point in the society, in the argument that you get what you pay for? This issue of poor doors or effectively how affordable housing is being incorporated with other housing was aired this week on Four Corners. And this week we also saw a really compelling piece from my next guest who's going to talk about what it's actually like to live like that. But you tell me, is it fair that people paying less rent have to walk through different doors, get different things? Is it just how we have to have it if we are to have affordable housing? Georgie Armstrong is a user experience designer in software app design, and she is my guest. Hello, Georgie. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for inviting me onto the show.
You wrote a really compelling piece about this this week in The Age. Tell me, what made you put pen to paper?
I very much believe that every system or model that isn't operating quite as well as we think, as well as it could, requires data in order to sort of make any tweaks improve that model. And I believe that while there is a lot of incredible benefits, which I'm living with, in, you know, with this capped rent in this current apartment block I'm in, I believe that there has been some unintended negative outcomes that if I raise this point and I add this data to the sort of to the considerations, we'll be able to improve it with further tweaks.
Mm. So you've written this piece, as I say, talking about how you feel. You take us through your journey into what led you into affordable housing. It was a mixture of things in your life. How did you feel when you got that deal, as you say, that is giving you benefits because you're paying less?
Yes. So I believe that I may, I haven't been on any waiting lists looking for housing, and I understand a lot of people have, and my heart goes out to them. I was genuinely on realestate.com just like everyone else, and domain sort of apps looking on the regular for a rental, and sort of lining up with 50 other people every time I went to look at a rental inspection. I just happened, I'd had a conversation with a friend around the ballot, a friend who had also won a spot and lived in that location for many years. And so it was on my mind that this was actually a function that sort of a Victorian state government had set up in order to assist people to get into secure housing. However, I literally just saw an apartment advertised and thought, wow, that's really good rent for Coburg and for a two-bedroom. And when I clicked on that, I saw that there was, it was a ballot, one of the ballot apartments, and I applied, given that I've only just been cleared to work again, and so my income is sort of I'm kind of starting again after my surgery.
And it would have seemed like a dream come true then. You get to do that. You have described it in this article as a dream community. When did you start to realise, well, tell us what is the experience then of having affordable housing in this? Tell us about what it feels like day to day.
As far as the dream community goes, that headline, I think, well, that wasn't my words. I do love the northern suburbs very okay. much. I came from.
But anyway, you had those aspirations.
Yeah, for sure. And I wanted to stay in it. I've been volunteering at a local op shop here, and I love this community. I've joined all the libraries, and for me to be able to stay in the northern suburbs and come to Coburg and sort of the Pentridge area was incredible and a real opportunity. And coming into the actual estate, it is, you know, it's a lovely spot. It's really well located. So I was very excited about that. And I think, when I describe in the article that initial walkthrough with the concierge around, you know, the amenities I was able to access and how things operated, it sort of started to dawn on me that while I understood it was a mixed tenure development, that there was a more, there was quite a clear delineation,
And can you describe what they are, Georgie?
Sure. So there are four shared amenities for the community here in the development to meet in. So so there's a rooftop garden with a lovely shared kitchen area. There is a 25-metre pool. There is a little no-frills rooftop, like half and quarter rooftop on another building. And there's a residence lounge. It has puzzles and a library.
So this is for people paying higher rent.
This is for people paying rent or who own. Yes, and for anyone who's in the affordable housing units, they only have access to the smaller exposed rooftop, which is still incredible. However, it means that when there is any community activities going on, those of us who are in the, like the games night that I attend, those of us who are in the affordable housing, we sort of have to wait in a common area and have someone collect us and take us into those other spaces. We aren't able to wander in and grab a puzzle or a book from the from the community library. We sort of have to wait until someone will come with us. And as I said in the article, we're all of the affordable housing apartments are sort of lumped onto floors, which are commonly known amongst the building development. So when someone says, what floor are you on? It's saying, it's essentially, are you in the affordable housing or not? And it becomes... It's really interesting when you come into a space and are a community-minded person that wants to sort of give and enjoy in the community, to feel like in my own building I'm not actually able to freely go to those places, and that I, while everyone else is included in that community, those of us on these floors are not included in that community.
Mm. So that's socially what it does. What does it do mentally, psychologically for you, Georgie?
I did struggle quite a bit at first when I realised what was going on, because I'm not used to that exclusion, or having that my economic status revealed without my consent every time I jump into the lift. And it's not that I believe myself to be less at all, because I respect equally the people on every floor here, and I really love the people that I have met from all of the different floors. However, it is, it's just not something that in my own home I feel like I should be having to disclose, without any control over that every time I step into the lift with whomever I step in with.
Mm. We will be talking about how this fits into our housing landscape with Dr. Liam Davies from RMIT University in a moment. But Georgie, you reference in your article what you've been told personally and what developers are saying, and we have invited the developer behind your apartment block on. They weren't available. We haven't heard from them yet today. But... you know that the developers in general say, look, apart from anything else, it's not illegal. It's definitely within the planning laws. It lowers costs overall because you're not paying for those amenities, so it keeps the costs of those amenities down if it's only for a few people. And also they're filling in for the housing. This is what we've been wanting, to put more affordable housing out there. What's your view on who's at fault? What should be done in this circumstance? If these issues are just fair enough, this is how it works, you know, you get what you pay for society.
Sure, that's one approach. This is how it works, but I think that's pretty lazy, personally. I understand that when you're designing these models, that economic viability and sustainability are a priority. I do understand that. However, we're dealing with a scenario that's fundamentally human. These are homes, and this is immediate community for people. And I'd love to see the lived experience factored in better. And I hesitate to use the word fault, but I actually believe that the ball lands firmly in the court of Vic Housing to solve this problem, because they're the ones setting the parameters around the model. I understand that the developers are money-making businesses that stand to create that economic viability for Victorian affordable housing. So they need to find a way for this to be economically viable. But I do believe that further consideration is required to make it a more conducive and more positive human experience for the people who are living here. And it also creates like a social disparity for the really lovely owners here who are like, oh, we really don't like that it's like this. We don't want people to feel excluded or have to wait to come into community spaces. So I feel like there's no one at fault in my building, and I actually think 3058 or PACE would be fair enough to sort of throw their hands in the air and say, oh, it's not our problem, you know, we're following the rules. But I do believe this needs to go back to the drawing board, and that more voices of those who are experiencing this on a day-to-day basis should be included in the conversation, and the problem can be solved from there.
Georgie, thank you so much for joining us this morning and giving us an insight into what it's like.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
That's Georgie Armstrong, who is a user experience designer in software app and also uses affordable housing. As I say, we have gone to the people behind the place where Georgie lives. We haven't got them available today. But as I say, there is an argument that they're using, like, well, they are helping solve a problem. Are they not in the housing experience? What is the design answer in all of this? Monica in Hampton, what did you want to say?
Oh, hi. So, Mary, look, we have a shocking situation in Hampton where we have the largest apartment block built on 100% public land by the railway line, and it's divided into four blocks. The poor door for the social housing is right down the end away from all the amenities. Then there's the affordable housing. We're not sure how much is there, but there are two blocks of luxury apartments with exclusive use of a rooftop deck, swimming pool with views, the most magnificent views of all of Port Phillip Bay.
And what do you think about that, Monica?
This is
the people who say that's fair enough. That's what they pay
on
for.
100% on 100% public land under the then Transport Minister Jacinta Allen. This was given over to a private developer rather than building much needed social and affordable housing.
Okay.
And
you don't like the fact that there are those luxury apartments there at all, rather than it being a mix?
No, that could have been given. It could have, if they wanted a public private partnership, they could have got Nightingale Park apartments there, where it's sort of more affordable. It's still the private developer, but there's, you know, there could have been this could have addressed a lot of housing issues.
Yeah, it's interesting, Monica, how much one development can answer that. Certainly we know, as you've pointed out, there are developers who are saying that they're getting the right mix. Are they? We will be talking to Dr. Liam Davies from RMIT very soon about that. Thank you, Monica, for calling. Jane in Oldham, you work with Livable Victoria, is that right?
Yes, I'm president of Livable Victoria, which is a volunteer organisation. Mm. We've brought many, well, over 50 community groups together on a variety of planning issues, but the affordable housing issue, the failure to deliver public housing, that is becoming a key issue at the moment, as we see the government ramping up the ability of private developers to deliver affordable housing.
So, Jane, you're talking about actually supplying the affordable housing. What have you seen through your work about this issue of the tensions of putting it side by side, literally, with other types of housing?
As Monica and as your guest Georgie explained, it is that social disparity, the issues around people not having access to the same facilities and how they feel about that, and how the other tenants feel too. It confirms what Georgie is describing.
That's right. Jane, thank you so much for calling in. Really great to get your perspective on that. I do need to go now to Dr. Liam Davies, who has been looking at this as a lecturer in sustainability and urban planning at RMIT University. And of course, your research actually looks straight at this, Liam. Thank you for joining me. As we heard there from Jane, as we heard there from Monica and Georgie, this is a friction that does spill over not just for people who live in affordable housing, but elsewhere as well. There are other neighbours as well. What's your answer? You've been looking at this. What's the answer to this design problem, Liam?
Well, thanks for having me to start with. I think that this is a problem of regulation. What we've seen is that increasingly in the last 10 to 15 years, as housing has gotten more financialized as an asset that we invest in for value and less a home, we've seen more pressure on the private development sector to provide affordable housing. And what we get is perverse outcomes like this. So this concept of a poor-door started about 10 years ago in London, where they would have a building that would have affordable housing and private market housing, and the private market housing was luxury through the front door, and the affordable housing was through a door for the poor out the back in an alleyway. And we're just seeing that come here as our system is starting to crumble in the same way that the London housing market was.
So we have Georgie's example there where there's no poor door, but there are, poor floors, I guess, is what, if we're going to be facetious about it. What is the design answer, though? I mean, I am seeing texts saying, look, it is you get what you pay for.
Yeah, but these developers aren't doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They're being either subsidised through programs like the HAF, or they're getting concessions on land through public-private partnership.
Sorry to interrupt you, Liam. They might not be doing it out of their own goodness of their own heart. They might have incentives, but are they not? They would argue solving a part of the problem of the housing crisis.
But they're also profiting from it.
Does that make a difference in terms of
this affordable housing? And I think that if they're making profit, we have a right as a society to expect standards of minimum dignity from the products they provide. I think that it's a real concern if we're starting to have developments that have two strata and classes of people being able to live there. And realistically, the cost thing, I'm not overly convinced on the cost. The argument here, there's an underlying assumption that people in affordable housing increase maintenance cost of a rooftop garden. Is it really going to make it cost that much more that it's a cost unbearable? Or is this a stigmatization of people on low income saying if we let them up there, they'll do damage?
Argument stack up?
Does it stack up? Because they've got to provide it either way. They're providing a 25-meter pool. All they're doing is providing and saying, but these people can't use it. How much extra would it actually cost to allow everyone to be able to use those assets?
You're listening to Liam Davies on The Conversation Hour on 774. Liam, I think you used a really interesting term there that gets to the heart of this, dignity. You're talking about the friction when it comes to, sure, even what Georgie's got, if you like, quote unquote, being on that lower rent is perfectly fine. It's the friction of knowing that someone right next to you has more, that they have to be kind and altruistic to invite you up to that part of the room. Is it about the signals we're sending out? I think you have said that it's like having a school that makes poor students walk through a different gate, maybe have them play in a different level of playground than the richer students. It's something that we wouldn't accept in most public-facing parts of life.
Most public-facing parts of life that are receiving government support. So a private school that gave scholarships to low-income students but didn't let them use the library, that would be an outrage. Yet for some reason, while the same level of government largesse is supporting affordable housing, those tenants are not being provided with the same level of service as let's call them regular or full paying tenants. But that cost is being passed on to government.
And so, Liam, you believe it all comes down to government. Do you think that there is the political will at the moment?
I think that at the moment housing is an incredibly difficult issue that we have, and what governments are trying to do is trying to increase supply as much as possible, and they're trying to use whatever levers they can. And in that, they are afraid to increase regulation and afraid to increase requirements onto developers for fear that developers would then turn around and say, well, we won't deliver the product. But what this means is that government is effectively paying to get a lower quality outcome. And I think that that has a social justice issue that we aspect that we really have to consider very strongly about. Is that the way that we want our government to operate, and is that the way we want our public resources to be used?
Liam, thank you so much for giving us your expert insight into this as well. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Liam Davies is lecturer in sustainability and urban planning at RMIT University. Looking exactly at this, I see on text, it's un-Australian. Others, though, say should be happy with what you've got. I'd love to continue this conversation. It is definitely something that is revealing something about our values and maybe our ability to regulate on this score. You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Now, coming up still you will have a defence of Melbourne coffee. I know I was stirring the pot yesterday. You can call me has been, if you like. Stick around and call in. It's also given me an idea about a regular segment. I'm going to throw that past you as well. But coming up next, what are the covers that surpassed the original? Tell me about those people who covered classics and made them even better. Could we be saying that of the Rolling Stones? We're going to get a review of the Stones' new album. That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, would you believe it? 25 albums later, the Rolling Stones have released another album. And here to tell us all about it, Al Newstead is Double J's music and pop culture reporter. Thank you so much, Al.
G'day, Mary. Thanks for having me.
It's called Foreign Tongues. I think that you noted in a piece on ABC News Online, it's the second album for the Stones when they're in their 80s.
That's right.
How does it stack up?
Well, let's put it this way. If you told this band back in the late 60s and 70s when they were releasing, you know, timeless records, hey, you're still going to be releasing albums in your 80s and actually you're going to be pretty good. I don't think anyone would have believed you, least of all the band. I think it's really solid. I think, yeah, as you mentioned, the 25th album, and it kind of feels like it's another little late career bump. And I don't think necessarily this will replace those classic records, but man, it's a really impressive effort. They've kind of rallied together a bunch of their peers, you know, people like Paul McCartney, Steve Winwood kind of contribute on there. They're playing and recording with their backing bands, who are some of those that kind of, particularly drummer Steve Jordan. Mm-hmm. He's a bit younger, and I think he's a really key part of this album. He's kind of got this real oomph to his playing that kind of forces the rest of the band to really up their game with their kind of rhythmic attitude, but it's still got all the hallmarks of the Stone sound. Mick Jagger, you know, he's still preening.
It's still just as good. Oh, yeah. I was listening for it thinking I'm going to listen out for, you know, the Frank Sinatra in his later years kind of wobble. No, it wasn't there. Definitely wasn't there.
No, and it does make me wonder if there's some studio trickery potentially going on, but he sounds great. You know, guitarists Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood, they're still trading licks like nobody's business. So, yeah, I just think it's really impressive for a band that has been doing it for this long and, you know, feeling like they haven't run out of fresh ideas and kind of just consolidating what they do so well this late in the game.
So they've still got fresh ideas. They did do a couple of covers, including, as I said, this cover of Amy Winehouse. So that's one cover I've been asking you today as well. What are the covers that did better than the original that you think absolutely smashed the original out of the park? Chris Clinton in Port Arlington, tell me, what do you think of this question?
I think the question is really almost disrespectful because you can't make anything better than the original.
Really?
Well, the original is the original. You can prefer it or it can be more popular, but it can't be better because the original is the bar.
What about if you take that song that is obviously a classic and obviously good and lends itself to other interpretations, but then you hear an interpretation that says, Clinton, nope, that's how it always should have been. You think that's just not valid.
But it can't be because it wasn't that way.
I love it. Clinton, you're a purist on this. Thank you for calling in. Darren in Wangaratta, what do you think of Clinton's argument?
Well, heard by Trent Reznor, was covered by Johnny Cash, and after it was released, Reznor even said that it's no longer his song.
Oh, there you go. That's pretty good. In fact, I think producer Amber nominated that for hers as well. Do we have that? No, we don't have that right now. I think we should get to it, though. Darren, have you listened to the Stones?
I've listened to the Stones.
Have you listened to the new one?
The new one I haven't.
Do you want to? Is it?
The Stones are the Stones. They're like, it's going to be quality no matter what.
It's going to be quality. Darren, thank you so much telling us about the qualities. Al Newsted, of course, from Double J. We should play a little bit more from it. This is a grab from the album Foreign Tongues, and this is the song In the Stars. So that's In the Stars from the Rolling Stones. That's one of their originals. We are also talking about covers, though, today. Before we get back to Al, Bianca in Fitzroy North, what do you think? Have you got a cover that beat the original?
Yes, I do. And it, as much as it pains me to say, it's Sinead O'Connor doing Nothing Compares to You.
Yeah.
Prince did the original, who I am such a fan of, but I think that her version just absolutely cuts it, you know. It's better, in my opinion.
It's better in your opinion. There you go, Bianca. Thank you. Al, just while we're on this topic, do you agree with Clinton? Do you think that, you know, essentially the songwriters never can be outdone?
No, I see where he's coming from. It's a spicy take, but, yeah, I don't think I wholeheartedly agree because, yeah, I kind of am right there with the Sinead O'Connor version. It's something where I think a really good cover can bring out something in a song that the original artist maybe didn't even hear themselves, which is exactly what happened with Johnny Cash's Hurt. But I can do it with Sinead O'Connor. Or, you have versions that people don't even realise are covers. You know, Natalie Imbruglia's Torn is a cover. Or even something like Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah. It kind of becomes the standard version where people think they're covering Hallelujah. They're actually covering Jeff Buckley's take rather than the original.
Exactly, then becomes better known. And I guess also a really interesting aspect of this new album from the Stones is just how many people have weighed in. You've got some really big names there joining in.
Yeah, absolutely. They've kind of pulled in all their famous friends and, you know, who says no to a Stones album, even if it's someone like Bruno Mars playing cowbell on a track. I had to check the credits to be like, really? But that track also features Robert Smith from The Cure, which is, you know, again, a combination you never would have expected decades ago in the band's prime. Who else have you got? I mentioned Paul McCartney. That's obviously a big deal. He provides a great bass line on Covered in You. And I think also even just having there's a posthumous recording from their former drummer, Charlie Watts, who sadly passed away in 2021. So, yeah, plenty of guest spots kind of livening up the track list on that
record.
Yeah,
I saw that you noted that, and I think it starts with the drums too, doesn't it? And it's just absolutely sort of chilling with that. Let's have a little listen to something else. This is from the album. It's called Jealous Lover. Already just within the few little snippets that we've heard, Al, a fair few different feels there. What was the story behind this album anyway? It didn't take them long to record, is that right?
No, so basically it's following on from their last record, Hackney Diamonds, which they recorded with a producer called Andrew Watt, who won a Grammy for his work and, yeah, basically reunited him and just kind of replicated the blueprint. I think with this one, there's kind of more of a kind of classic, gutsier, guitar-driven Stone sound. And I think what's really important noting too is rather than just being nostalgic, they've kind of got a lot of, modern-sounding techniques, but also Jagger in his lyrics offering his disillusionment on the current state of affairs, particularly in the US. Mm. There's a swipe at Elon Musk. There's a lot of kind of, you know, he's not explicitly mentioned, but there's a lot of kind of Trump allusions, a lot of protests against America's social unrest at the moment, which is, you know, again, kind of hearkening to their back catalogue with hits like Street Fighting Man, Gimme Shelter. So it's not come out of nowhere. But I think that gives this the record, particularly lyrically, like a modern edge that really brings it into the modern. It's not just, you know, them echoing their past work.
Indeed. The headline to your piece was it was a late career peak in their 80s. We would be looking for the 26th album, surely.
Oh, look, I reckon they're thinking about it. I think really what's going to work is hearing these songs live. Again, it's not going to supplant the classics, but I don't think you're going to be ducking off to the bathroom or you know, having a toilet break for these songs. I think they really are solid and stand up. And, yeah, I'm sure that they're wanting to be getting right back in the studio or back on the road with this album.
Back on the road. How old will they be then?
Well, I mean, they haven't been here in 12 years, so it'd be great if we get one last hurrah. You know, the AC/DC recently did what they said was their final tour, so, mm-hmm. You know, there's always a chance.
Oh, that's exactly right. And we've got a whole heap of 50-year anniversary tours this year, so it's not as if the crowd that's going to be showing up to see them is part of it. And I guess just as a final question then for you, Al, I think you also note in your article, because you have all of these people, like you mentioned Robert Smith from The Cure, who are themselves basically babies when they first heard The Stones, it's a wonderful tribute also to The Stones' back catalogue that all of these people are actually there and contributing to the album.
It's about legacy, you know. It's despite all of the controversies over the years, and I think, you know, the Rolling Stones, they're a legendary act, and it's kind of remarkable that they just refuse to retire. They refuse to kind of settle and just keep putting music out. And I think particularly with these last two records, rather than tarnish their legacy and put out very, you know, putting out records for the sake of it, it really does feel like they're kind of reconnecting and understanding that, like, hey, we can actually just go back to basics and knock out some great records. And just how many artists in the 80s can you name were actually doing that? So I think it's worth honouring that.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Al.
No worries, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Al Newstead is Double J's music and pop culture reporter. Maybe you can answer that question, how many in their 80s can do it? You're also answering my question, when are covers better than the original? Cliff, what do you think? Hello, Cliff. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Sorry, gang.
Hello. It's Mary on the radio. You were going to tell us a cover that's better than the original?
Mary, I have got probably the biggest collection of covers that are better than the original in the world. I would dare to claim, and I have two words to say, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan? Covers of Bob Dylan?
Starting with Joan Baez, Blowin' in the Wind. She actually brought Mr. Dylan to fame with that cover. Right up through the years, we've got Elton John, Olivia Newton-John covering If Not For You.
Mm-hmm.
That is a great version.
Oh, it's beautiful. Do they do it better than Bob?
Absolutely. And the cover of all time in rock, I would say, is Jimi Hendrix covering Dylan's All Along the Watchtower.
Basically, you're saying Bob was just serving it up for others there, Cliff.
Bob is one of the great songwriters of our time, and it'll be life before Dylan and life after Dylan when the sad day arrives. But, yes, he has provided so much raw material. I mean, Johnny Cash.
Exactly, as well. Cliff, thank you. Do you agree with Cliff? That's pretty controversial. Bob Dylan's there, well, as an assist. 1300 222 774. Kirsty in Glen Iris, you have a nomination for the best cover?
Yeah, I do.
I think you might have to turn off your radio there, Kirsty, or walk away from it. But what's your nomination?
My nomination is something that brings me to my knees and cry every time I hear it. Sort of a half and half, but it's Eddie Vedder with Neil Finn singing Throw Your Arms Around Me.
Oh,
and it's just
yeah.
Those two with a guitar live just singing that. And it is just, yeah, it's just unbelievable. Everyone that I play it to, they're like, but then when I show you it's exactly a cover because we've got one of the originals there. But, yeah.
I agree with you, Kirsty. It's a different interpretation as a duet, isn't it? Two men singing that song.
That's right. That's right. And, yeah, everybody needs to hear it. And when they do, think of my friend Tracy. Yeah, you guys have a great show.
Thank you.
I will come to you at night time, and I will raise you from your sleep. I will kiss you in four places as I go running along your streets.
Yeah, there is that for you, Kirsty. A little bit later, maybe we'll get to the Eddie Vedder part later, but it is beautiful. Sounds different right from the start in any case. And even better when Eddie Vedder joins in. Thank you so much, Kirsty, for your nomination. And Jill in East Malvern, what's yours?
Oh, hi, Mary. Look, when I was 14 when the Beatles came out, well, they came to Australia, luckily I was there. However, you know, we didn't even know that some of their stuff were covers, like Twist and Shout, Law of Beethoven. And Elvis Presley, his early stuff was often covers of blues, black blues singers at the time, and he brought them to prominence with his covers.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So, as I said, and I'm so excited about the Stones, I have to say, as an add-on, is I saw the Beatles when I was 14 and they came to Australia, and then the first time the Stones came to Australia, I saw them too.
Okay, so, Jill, you're the perfect person to ask that age-old question, Beatles v Stones.
Well, I love the Beatles, and I was fortunate enough a little while ago to go to Liverpool and do the whole Beatles thing.
Oh, yeah.
But the Stones, when we saw them in concert, they just blew us away. Girlfriends and I went, and we were only young, and we had never seen anything like Mick Jagger in our whole life.
And so will you be listening to the new album, Jill?
Unbelievably so. I love it. I love the Stones and I love the Beatles, and that was my era. I'm 76, so I've
and
really
still
been
rocking it. I can tell.
And still rocking it.
Good on you, Jill. Yes, tell me what you think. You get listening to the Stones, maybe with fresh ears, and those fresh songs. I want to keep those conversations going if I can on the Conversation Hour. But also, look, it's time for the rebound. You will have heard me sledging Melbourne Coffee yesterday. The debate has been brewing. Is it a storm in a coffee cup? I will tell you all about it. Ben Lomas will be joining me and smacking me down on that argument. 1300 222 774 is the number. If you want to join him and me in conversation, let's talk about whether it is true that Melbourne is fooling itself about the quality of its coffee.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So, if you didn't hear yesterday, kind of kicked a hell of beans around by talking about coffee. A good friend of mine, James Paniki, had written a piece talking about how we really were deluding ourselves about the quality of the coffee, and especially when it's so pricey. Let's have a little listen to the nub of his argument.
I don't think coffee is particularly good in Melbourne or in Australia. This is really just a marketing strategy. It's the sort of the coffee industry that wants it to be good. It keeps on telling us that it's good. And as a result, we're lapping up all of the talking points from anyone selling coffee.
So that we were pretty much in lockstep. I agreed with James the whole way, and actually a surprising number of listeners were on our side as well. But Ben Lomas is going to take this on. He is comedian, a great comedian, about coffee and other things, and also brings to it his knowledge as a former barista. Ben joins me now. Hi.
Hello, everyone. Can I just correct it? I am, when I say former barista, I've just had enough coffee that I feel like I can justify I could be one.
Oh, okay. All right. But like, you've got a love of coffee.
Love it, coffee. But I think you've got it all wrong. We just live in the greatest city, that hands down. But what complements the city is the coffee. And I feel sorry for you and possibly James. Clearly, James has never had a good cup of coffee.
Au contraire, he'll say that he had it in Italy.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Italy, see, I just think they've got it all wrong, okay? Coffee in this amazing country is about community, okay? You have your local cafe. You wake up in the morning, you and your partner, head walk across there, get a delicious cup of coffee, and the cafe, the barista, knows your name, knows your order, knows what kind of coffee you like. That's what makes this so special. Because I live in Brunswick, right? And a cafe and a cafe opens, a new cafe opens every 3 minutes, okay? So we're spoiled for choice. But I think, James, I think it's a bit of a fantasy land. You live in Melbourne, yes, things are more expensive. But you know what? Wages are better than here than compared to Italy. So things are going to get a bit pricey. But I think if you want a good coffee, you just tell the barista what you want and they'll make it for you.
Okay, 1300 222 774. If you'd like to weigh in, if you agree with Ben, or if you agree with me and James. Ben Lomas is comedian. We're talking about the quality of coffee. The thesis is Melburnians and Australians are fooling themselves. It's not that good in the first place and it's overpriced. So, James, what you're saying as a Brunswickian, and yes, I'm very familiar with that area as well, is that you're not just paying for bitter beans, you're actually paying for a whole experience. Now, that's not what we're paying for, is it? When it goes down, like it feels like it's the bottom of an ashtray when it, because it's just so bitter and yuck.
Where are you getting your coffee?
I'm getting it from a cafe in Brunswick when I get my espressos. And I personally think that's the key. Everyone's thinking about milk drinkers, not me.
Even if you have an espresso or a short black or a long macchiato, then if it's not good the first time, tell them. Because this is the thing. You can go there. When you go to a bar, you don't go, oh, give us whatever red wine. Maybe you like a Merlot. Maybe you like a Pinot. Like, you can ask for what you want, but you don't just suck it up. Next time you go, oh, I know this is crazy, go to a different cafe. It's crazy. I know. It's a wild suggestion, but...
Oh, yeah, Ben's taking it down to basics. Tell me if you agree, 1300 222 774. You know, basically someone is accusing us of rage bait here. This has given me an idea for a segment. Just we'll continue this coffee chat in a moment, Ben. But this is what I thought after yesterday. Everyone really liked having the chance to kind of get that bugbear off their chest, some things that are just aren't that serious but make us inexplicably grumpy. I want to start a segment called Rolodex of Grievance.
The Rolodex of Grievance.
And it has stopped on coffee today. But Ben, what do you think? Do you think that people just need to have a good old whinge about coffee every so often and that clears the air?
Maybe. I just feel sorry. I know that when I go to my local cafe, because you were talking about the prices. Yes, I agree. Coffee is a bit expensive and I think groceries are expensive. But you know how you can get your coffee that little bit cheaper? Bring a keep cup. You know, save the environment. Feel good about yourself. You know, you're going to get your caffeine hit, but feel like, you know, you planted a tree at the same time.
Plant a tree, like, every time you spend $6 on a...
No, it's not $6. See, I read the article. It's not $6. If you go up to a cafe, you've got a keep cup. It can be, but you didn't bring a keep cup, did you?
Paul, you're in South Australia and you want to weigh in.
Yeah, well...
Don't tell me it's better there.
It is. I think it's just as good. Put it this way, I'm a coffee freak. I grew up with Calabrians drinking short blacks with a dash of grappa first thing in the morning.
Oh.
So I have my own stovetop machine just like the Italians use, and I'm pretty fussy about my coffee. But the best coffee I've ever tasted and is actually Mount Gambier, a bloke there. And the test for coffee is if you can drink a short black without sugar and it's not bitter.
That's exactly right. And so I need to go to Mount Gambier. Is that right, Paul?
There's a little shop in the main street of Mount Gambier. It's just like a little hole in the wall. He's got a piano out the front where people can play with, and it's some of the best coffee I've ever tasted. And look, I've travelled. I've been in Europe and I've been in America. American coffee is disgusting. I got told in New York we only sell American coffee here. So
And the coffee is not blue?
Oh, blue like the lake.
Blue like the Lake.
That lake changes colour quite often. Actually.
Yeah, that's right. It might turn green after a while.
Yeah, well, I hope not. They actually drink that water.
Paul, thank you. I'm writing Mount Gambier down now. That's a reason enough for tourism. Someone else says, anyway, I love gum shriveling, bitter black coffee. It's the only way to drink it, and milk is for babies. Ben, I don't think anyone can actually say that my palate is better than yours, but that's basically what you're saying to me, isn't it?
Well, I don't think your palate's better than mine. I just think you just need to move on to the next cafe. Or, more excitingly, get a really nice keep cup and then find your barista. Maybe flirt a little. Maybe they'll find out what you really like. I think there's an opportunity to find a good cafe. We are so spoiled in this city, I think. And I think if you can find the right barista who can make the coffee for you, then, again, what a great day to start the day and support the local community.
There you go. Public service announcement to end on. Ben Lomas, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You
and
too.
Enjoy your coffee.
Yes, indeed. Drink that coffee as much as it costs. Ben Lomas is a comedian and coffee lover as well. And we're talking about the great covers that surpass the originals. Rowan in Tura. You got a nomination?
Yeah, I've the young Love You So, but In Excess, I reckon they did an edgier version.
Oh, yeah. I love that version. Yeah,
great song.
It is.
Anyway, I'm more of a tea Jenny than the coffee snob.
That's good. It really does mean that you don't have that grievance in. Do you have another grievance about tea? Do you have a suggestion for this segment that I'm trying to get off the ground?
Oh, look, I think you did enough tannin out of me tea and caffeine out of me coffee. I'm not a coffee snob, but it all tastes like coffee.
The cost of tea, would they just put a tea bag in? I've heard people talk about that.
Yeah, I don't care. I'm happy to sit there and have a cup of tea while everyone else is cappuccinoing away and short black and whatever, all the other chino things you can get.
Yeah. Rowan, I love it. I love that you've introduced some peace to me just trying to be a ornery old thing with my Rolodex of grievance. I'm going to get it off the ground. Thank you for joining me on the Conversation Hour. Tell me what grievance you'd like to have aired. Conversation Hour at abc.net.au.